Back together again with you midweek Wednesday style, February 26, 2025, right here on Connecticut Today, where I weighed in again on a continued push to lower Connecticut's blood alcohol DUI standard from 0.08 to 0.05 as a way to determine impairment. Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist Dan Haar joined us with his weekly wrap-up, including his thoughts on the continued controversy over the release of a confessed cannibal killer. We welcome Sacred Heart University Professor Emeritus Dr. Michael Higgins on to talk about his new book, The Jesuit Disruptor, A Personal Portrait of Pope Francis. And finally, CBS News correspondent Olivia Rinaldi dropped by to chat about today's Trump cabinet meeting in D.C. featuring Elon Musk. So how many of you, when you go out maybe with, a work friend or work friends maybe once a week, or you go out with your domestic partner, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your husband, your wife, and, you know, you go out and you go to your favorite bar, restaurant, lounge, grill, club, and you like to have, you know, maybe a couple of drinks. I never have more than one, but I'm on a bunch of medication, nothing serious, but I'm like, I drink like three or four times a year, maybe. But maybe you have two drinks. Maybe you have a drink before dinner and a drink during dinner, and you say, hey, that's it. No. Or maybe you have one large drink if, you know, hey, I'm going to have one beer, but it's a good size one, whatever. Here's the bottom line. You're conscious of your alcohol intake because you know that the limit in Connecticut and in all states except one is 0.08 as a blood alcohol limit. What that number means, 0.08 of 1% blood alcohol. Meaning 0.08, 0.08 of 1% is what we deem to be the level at which, and there's some debate about this, some people will say any amount of alcohol impedes you, but at 0.08, that is the national recognized level that you have to be at, and everybody is at that now except Utah. And you have to be at that. It used to be 0.1, 0.12, whatever, to get federal highway funding. So nobody, with the exception of Utah, is other than 0.08. 0.08, if you remember your decimal places, the first one is tenths, the second one is hundredths, 0.08 of 1%. Now, Utah is at 0.05, and for some reason, Connecticut has a push now to go to that. Now, the reason I bring up the beer is, now, for guys, it's a little different. We tend to be a little bigger, body mass, whatever. But ladies, listen up here. And this was mentioned by a expert that we've cited. We had a sound clip from Sacred Heart University. If we go from 0.08, now, just keep this in mind. I want you to know this. If we go from 0.08 to 0.05, for maybe a smaller individual or a smaller man or, you know, an average to small-sized woman, that second drink will put you over 0.05. In fact, Chris, do we have that expert? Can you, I should have asked you for this before, can you pull up that bite that we have of that expert from, I think it was Sacred Heart, who talked about the, if you can pull that up for me. I'm sorry, should have prepped you on this. Who talks about maybe just a second drink for a woman if we go to 0.05, which, again, people may want to go to. But why are we doing this? You know, why are we doing this? Are we going to create criminality here? Now, this is not me saying it. This is a local professor. I guess he's in physiology or training and understands the interaction with the body and blood alcohol.
For a male, a 200-pound male, that's about one beer difference in an hour. If you talk about a 130-pound female, it could be the difference between a half a beer over that 1 hour that's going to make that difference. So, I mean, that's a pretty significant drop.
Dr. Bo Greer, thank you, Chris. Appreciate that. Dr. Bo Greer, Sacred Heart University, saying for a woman, if we go to 0.05, an extra half beer could then put you in danger of a DUI. Now, I know what you're saying. You say, well, Paul, less alcohol is a good thing. Okay, I understand it. But there's this troubles me because of a specific point. And I'll explain that coming back, and you'll be able to understand it. Don't worry about that. So we'll talk about that straight ahead. All right, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You okay with the state lowering its blood alcohol level for impairment from 0.08 to 0.05? Only Utah does this. Nobody else does this. And again, there is no empirical study that says doing this is going to lower road deaths. And I'm telling you why they're doing this, because they know marijuana is heavily involved in some of these DUIs, and they just don't want to say it, so they're going to blame it all on booze. And the first time this was brought up a couple of years ago, and they did it last year, they pretty much said, hey, people are mixing marijuana with alcohol. You hear it all the time. Now, here's the problem. And I'll just ask you a simple question here. You can chime in if you like at 333-9422, 203-333-9422. Whenever we hear at the radio station throughout the day or any other media, the Hearst papers online, print media, whatever, internet-based or radio or TV, whenever we hear about these sad accidents that cause cause loss of life, and you invariably hear me talk about it, or Chris, or John, or Melissa, or Lisa, and you hear about the blood alcohol level in somebody that ostensibly caused the accident, which, sadly, a lot of times, lives are lost. Do you ever hear of anything around, slightly above the legal limit, 0.08, 0.9, 0.10. You don't. Now, I never say you never do. But the bottom line is, these people that cause accidents like this, right? What do we hear? State police say the driver, Mary Jones, was later found to have a blood alcohol content of 0.16, right? Or 0.14, or, 0.10, or 0.18. And they say, well, that's twice the legal limit. 0.24, three times the legal limit. You never hear of, well, I shouldn't say you never, that I got to be careful of that, but you hardly ever hear of any fatal DUI where somebody says, well, the driver involved had a blood alcohol content of 0.06. You never hear that. But under this bill, if this bill passes, you just heard our expert there from Sacred Heart saying, hey, you know what, ladies, and within an hour, a half a beer, ladies, could put you into the technically impaired category. What do we need that for? Well, Paul, it's going to lower DUIs. We don't know that. See, this is what drives me nuts when stuff goes on in Hartford. Well, this could go a long way towards saving lives. Okay, and it could also go a long way to getting somebody arrested who previously wouldn't have been arrested. I don't understand this. Well, I'm saying that rhetorically. I do understand it, because they know the marijuana and driving thing is out of control. So, common sense would say, let's lock down on people who are using pot. But again, as we've told you, as I've told you, and as experts have said, the cops really have their hands tied here. Even if they think they see somebody smoking a joint, there's very little they can do. Even if they pull somebody over and there are no lit joints in the car, if they smell marijuana coming out of the car, believe it or not, the way the law is written here in the state, there's very little, if anything, they can do. So instead of going after the real problem, which a lot of people are finally starting to admit is, hey, the marijuana driving thing, yeah, we were told about this. It was going to happen one, two, 3 years after we do this. We heard from people in Oregon and in California, whatever. And they say, well, Connecticut, you're going to get yours. So instead of backtracking on that and saying, hey, maybe we should amend the law, maybe we should give the cops, the local police, and the state police a bit more authority here. No, we will now, in true Connecticut fashion, go after people, much the way we go after gun owners, the law-abiding gun owners. We want to, for some reason now, go after law-abiding adults who are responsible in the way they consume alcohol. Listen, if you're over .08, then throw the cuffs on you, go to jail, stay there, dry out, go to court. I get it. I understand it. Happened to a friend of mine. He's cleared of the charges. He was .09, and it cost him like $15,000 in legal fees. And he didn't realize he was going to blow a .09. But why are we going to lower this to .05? It doesn't make any sense when there is no long-term empirical data in several states to say this works. And again, don't look at me. Don't listen to me if you don't believe me. You heard that expert that we contacted from Sacred Heart, who said, hey, you go to .05 from .08, that's a half a beer if you're a normal-sized woman. Does that make any sense? And you may say, well, any amount of lower alcohol is good, I guess. But then again, I ask you, do you ever hear news accounts, either on this station or in TV or online or in print, where they say, you know, the alleged impaired driver or the driver involved in a lethal DUI was found to have a blood alcohol limit of 0.06 or 0.07. It doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. The people that kill people in a DUI crash generally, not always, generally are smashed. You hear it all the time. They're at 0.15, 0.16, 0.20. Ask any cop, you know. They'll tell you. Let's go to Chris in Oxford before news. Hey, Chris, good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, Paul. How you doing?
What's up?
So are we assuming now that nobody was driving around high before weed was legal? I mean,
I think
the numbers are the same, if you ask me.
No, I think they're worse. No, every study, Chris, in where states institute legal weed, the number of car accidents always goes up.
And it's tethered to alcohol, or they're just doing it sort of like just to, I don't know. Like, how do they tie together? Just missing that.
Well, here's the deal. In other words, we were warned. Oregon warned us. I had a couple of guests on too, said, hey, any state where you legalize weed, it's going to go up and people will naturally mix the weed and the alcohol. And there was an admission, Chris, I'll pull the article up on the break. There was an admission a couple of months ago, even by state police and local police, that they are finding a lot more people mixing booze and weed. Yeah.
So then the next question would be to that is, like, why associate it with alcohol? Why can't they find a way to find people that are smoking marijuana and driving on their own without tethering it to alcohol?
They are trying, Chris. The science is not there yet. They're trying. Some people were tested. I think it was the University of Pittsburgh. They're testing a device that kind of looks like a breathalyzer, but it would analyze your saliva to try and figure out THC. But from what I understand, Chris, it's a much harder measurement to do. They say, you know, blood alcohol is easy. You can either take a blood draw or you blow into a breathalyzer. But they can't figure. There's nothing simple for weed yet.
Yeah, that's my fault for thinking that, you know, they would actually think logically on that instead of attacking alcohol and not the actual problem.
So now, thank you, Chris, for the call. So now they want to go to 0.05. And as that expert we said, well, you know, you go to 0.05 for a normally built to slightly built woman, that's a half a beer. What's that, 4 ounces if you go with an 8-ounce glass? It's a half a beer. So you're creating criminals. I mean, seriously, what happens if a woman goes out with her friends, girls' night out, or she meets her boyfriend somewhere and she's driving home alone and there's a DUI checkpoint, ma'am? You're okay. Can you just blow in this? And you know, she puffs out a .06. I'm sorry, so she blows out, you know, like a .06. Well, ma'am, you're above the limit. What? Or a .07. Like, officer, I'm just coming from, you know, a restaurant. I never have more than two drinks. Yeah, well, you know what? Under this, that second drink could be bad news. Yeah, and continuing real briefly here before news, the marijuana versus alcohol connection here. Getting a call here from a gentleman who I had on the program a couple of times as we were debating marijuana, Pastor Carl McCluster. Pastor, it's Paul. How are you, sir?
Hey, Paul. Thanks for letting me in. You know, real quick.
Yeah.
We warned you about weed.
Yep.
We had the lesson in Colorado, had the lesson in Washington. Nobody wanted to listen because people wanted to make money, and that's all about money. It's not about caring about kids or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the mixture is, all right, let's count then. Let if you're going to report one, report the other. And I'm just disappointed that we want to point the finger away from something that we know is harmful for the development, for the intellectual development, mm-hmm. of our young people, and point it towards alcohol as a culprit for what is at the very, very best a joint effort to disable our kids.
Sure. Pastor McCluster, good to hear from you, Pastor. Thanks, and we got to get you back on the program there. Pastor Carl McCluster, who was one of the urban voices, I give him credit, in the big cities a few years ago, saying, no, 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 we don't need legalized marijuana. It's that time of the week again. I've had people in the front office say this is their favorite segment in the entire week. Dan Haar is with us, Hearst Connecticut Media, senior columnist and editor. Mr. Haar, how are you, sir?
Favorite segment. Wow, that's a big deal.
Yeah, well, yeah, right. You know, yeah. I've had people come up to me and say, "Hey, I like that Dan Haar guy." So look at that. You're a star. You're a star, Dan. How about that, huh? Huh?
They're closet liberals.
Well, a couple of them are. Hey, listen. Before we talk about your columns, before we talk about Lamont versus his own party, before we talk about Trump, how about we talk a little cannibalism? What are your thoughts on this, Dan, now that this board is coming out and kind of trying to defend this release of this, shall we say, unfortunate gentleman? What are your thoughts here?
I guess, you know, we shouldn't say things like Connecticut is eating its own. In any case, the parole board gave a statement to my colleague that they have not had a case of recidivism, mm-hmm. in the psychiatric parole review board since 1985,
mm-hmm.
right? So basically they're saying, look, we got this, right? We think this guy, and of course, obviously there are controls on where he can be and live. There was an unfortunate reality, which is one of the relatives of the victim in Bridgeport, yeah. were not informed of the full proceedings here, which is not supposed to happen. But the main, I think, point is that, you know, this always happens in a parole. Whenever there's a parole hearing where somebody has met the qualifications to be released, or in this case, partially released, or really released, it rankles the public. And politicians make statements when it's a notorious crime.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a very notorious crime, so it makes it all the harder to swallow. But the board is saying, look, we know what we're doing here.
Yeah, I certainly hope they do. And, you know, I hope this guy maintains his medication. And there are people with medical backgrounds saying, you know, if he does that, we're okay with this. So I think fingers crossed here. The governor is jousting, Dan, not really with Republicans on stuff, but again, with his own party. We're seeing finger pointing about funding, particularly with special ed. What are your thoughts on this?
He's got to joust with his own party, because if he only jousts with Republicans, he's going to run out of people to joust with at the Capitol. This is $40 million that everybody agrees is a good policy use of that $40 million. The state reimburses towns for special ed, among many other things, yeah. Education especially. And in special ed, when the special ed costs reach a certain point, both per student and in the aggregate for a town, they get reimbursed. That fund is underfunded chronically. Mm-hmm. And so nobody likes that. It's sort of, you know, special ed is increasingly viewed as the type of service that should be shared. The burden of the cost should be shared across the state.
Yeah.
So there isn't a debate about spending the money. There's a debate about why are you picking this to reimburse now when we have, in the words of Jeffrey Beckham, the budget chief for the mm-hmm. for Lamont, we have other accounts that are also short. Let's wait till the end of the year and see what we're going to do. Because if you budget for this now, we may then be technically over out breaking the rules, the mm-hmm. budget rules, the famous guardrails. Mm-hmm. That's the debate. So it's really it's not so much a debate about this $40 million. Everybody generally agrees it's good use of money.
Sure.
It's a debate about whether the legislature can or should set aside money to fill one hole when we have other holes unfilled. It's a power struggle. It's not a money struggle.
Yeah, but according to the calls I take here on the show, Anna, Dan, you probably heard this too. It is one of these things, though. It's not like, all right, highway money or stuff like that. Because invariably, we all know somebody, a friend or an immediate family member or a niece or a nephew or uncle, grandfather, who there's kind of a blood tie to somebody who either has received special ed or who needs that in their school system. And I think that's kind of cranked up the emotions on this a little bit anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the special ed services are being provided. The question is who pays for them,
yeah.
Whether the towns have to pay for them and then have to eventually cut in some other area. It's really, this debate highlights the fact that we have a patchwork system for paying for special ed that really needs to be revamped completely, and this is just a temporary fix.
A couple things you wrote about. Number one, electric rate cuts, and there are two times a year, obviously, where rates are set and recalibrated. What are your thoughts on that first?
Well, my thoughts on it are that people are looking to legislators and regulators to help, quote, lower the cost of electricity in Connecticut, and I'm sorry to have to report that that's not going to happen.
You always say soon. That. You always say it. And you're right. Yeah. You're 100% right.
Well, but in this case, in the case of Eversource, the average bill is going to go down by $4 a month on May 1st as the mid-year revision, right? And you think, wow, that's great, down. But don't forget, last year, the mid-year revision was up $48. So you're up $48 in 24. You're down $4 in 25.
Uh-huh.
Are you happy with the down $4?
No, you're probably not. No, you're right. Before we get to wrapping up with Mr. Trump, because, of course, you are still a registered Republican, I guess.
Absolutely.
How do you think the whole Pura, Marissa Gillette, okay, we'll add two more people to Pura. How do you think that all shook out? Were you surprised of anything or not there?
No, I wasn't surprised. I was surprised that it took a deal to get Senator John Fonfara on the Pura board so that he makes a whole lot more money in the last few years of his career. I'm surprised that it took that. I thought she would have the support she needed in the heavily Democratic House and Senate without that. But it took that, and there you go.
Yeah, all right. Donald Trump, we're about a month in. Harvard survey came out the other day, Harvard and Harris. Of course, Democrats hate him, Republicans love him, and independents are 50-50. He's right around 50 or 51%. What are your thoughts?
Well, the constitutional officers led by Attorney General William Tong had a gathering where they really assessed how things are going. And the answer is, as to how Connecticut is doing in fighting the Trump orders, it's a mixed picture. There have been some successes and some failures. The big takeaway to me, aside from the mess of immigration, and we don't know where that's going, is that these budget cuts are having a very real harm now. It is not a threat. They are having a very real harm now. And you know, these officers outlined, there was a young woman there from New Haven whose program has been cut. This was giving jobs to kids at a New Haven high school. to work on environmental and community issues, those jobs are now over. And A, they needed the money, and B, those jobs were doing good things in the community. So that's just one of many examples, and I think that's the big takeaway. The harm is happening now. It's not a theoretical future, oh, this might happen.
Dan Harhurst, Connecticut Media. Dan, before we let you go, you want to tease anything coming up? What might you be working on right now that folks should keep an eye out for? Anything?
Immigration issues.
What was that again? Immigration? Oh.
Immigration issues. Yeah, they're really – things are happening, and we'll be following that.
Excellent. Dan Harhurst, Connecticut Media. Dan, be good. Have a happy weekend. We'll talk to you next week, sir. Thank you.
Have a good week.
All right. Dan Harhurst, Connecticut Media there. He is writing more stuff about immigration. All right. And let's do a segment here for the large and growing Catholic population in our market, Lower Fairfield County. Word today that the Holy Father, Pope Francis, now he's not out of the woods by any means. He's an 88-year-old gentleman with double pneumonia, but the word is he's doing a bit better today. And we welcome to the program here Dr. Michael Higgins, Sacred Heart University Professor Emeritus, that has published a book, The Jesuit Disruptor. I like that. The personal portrait of Pope Francis, who was in the news, and people are already, despite the fact that he is doing a bit better, they're already saying, hey, who will succeed him? What will his lasting input be? Dr. Higgins, it's Paul here on WICC. Great to have you with us. How are you?
Not too bad. Thank you for having me, Paul.
Pope Francis, you know, I find among Catholics, Dr. Higgins, there's, I don't know whether you agree with this or not, there's really no middle ground on this Pope. I know people that adore the guy, that love him, and people who have a little less than an appreciative attitude toward him. What are your thoughts on that?
That's quite right, actually. Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Pope Francis, the current Supreme Pontiff, is loved by many, particularly at the global level, and particularly by non-Catholics. The only significant opposition we have to Francis, or any form of adverse opinion, seems to be generated by small pockets of disaffected Catholics who see Francis as somebody who has abandoned the tradition, as somebody who has compromised dogma, as somebody who has shaken the Roman papacy to its core. These are caricatures. They're fears. None of those are true. The Pope is an organic conservative. He's committed to preserving the unity of the Church. It's just that he's given priority to the pastoral. He's privileged mercy over law. And he has opened his arms to receive the world without judgment. And for some Catholics, that's just not a go.
Now, I guess, Dr. Higgins, you will be discussing this and the Holy Father and your book coming up at an event tomorrow night, the 27th at 7 p.m. in the Dr. Michelle Loris Forum at the Frank and Marissa Martire Center on the campus of Sacred Heart University. So if folks want to go to that, what can they glean from that discussion tomorrow?
Well, it's going to be interesting, Paul, because there are it's a kind of a tri-university panel. There are representatives from Fordham University in New York, Fairfield University, of course, which is the Jesuit University in Fairfield, and Sacred Heart. And so these representatives will be with me discussing the book, its strengths, its weaknesses, and it's particularly timely given, as you indicated at the beginning up front, the fragility of the Pope's health has the world alerted to the fact that it is possible, if not imminent, certainly possible, that Francis may be at the threshold of his life. Now, he is 88. He has a checkered history as far as health is concerned. His recent experience of health decline has been quite serious. It appears to have been mildly reversed or at least stabilized. Regardless, the Pope has experienced a direct threat to the continuity and continuance of his papacy. And if he survives this, and we hope certainly that he does. He's a remarkable man, and we hope we have more years with him. But if he survives this, of course, his system will be further weakened, given his age and given his track record.
He has, Dr. Higgins, named a number of new members to the Cardinal College, the College of Cardinals, recently, and a lot of them are young enough to where they can, you know, they can vote for his successor. Any thoughts, any handicapping on, even if he emerges from this, he's not a young man, he's pushing 89, he will be either stepping down or gone soon. Any thoughts on where the Catholic Church and the College of Cardinals goes after him?
That's a very good question. And for the first time in a long time, it is difficult to draw some conclusions. Can speculate a bit, and I'll do that for you, Paul.
Sure.
But you're quite correct in terms of his creating new cardinals. That's the technical word. They don't appoint, they don't anoint, they don't delegate, they create. So cardinals are created, and he has created quite a number of cardinals throughout the world, some of them from the what is called the peripheries or marginal areas, some from more traditional sees. So he has somewhere, I think, around 130 to 140 range of cardinals, but many of the if he were to die during the course of this year, that number of cardinal electors will be in the low 120 range. Of that, of those cardinals, many of them have been created during his pontificate. A significant number of them are young. Many of them don't know each other. So it's important that they get to know how they think and what are the kind of criteria that they want to apply to elect a pope to succeed Francis. What does the church need at this time on the global scene in terms of its institutional leadership? So it's going to be a very interesting transition when it occurs, and we don't know when that's going to happen, but when it occurs, it will be very interesting because the last pope, of course, as you know, resigned.
Yeah.
And so as a consequence, we haven't really had the kind of serious mooting or reflecting on succession in an extended way since actually the death of John Paul II. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens.
And finally, Dr. Higgins, hasn't the pontiff said that he would consider stepping aside or would step aside if he feels he cannot continue any further?
He's indicated that should he be incapacitated, that's right.
Okay.
That he will resign. But he's also indicated that he leads with his brain, not with his legs. So my sense is that when he talks about incapacitation, he would mean significant cognitive impairment. Because as long as he can breathe, as long as he can walk, or not walk, but be mobile in his electric chair, which he is not his electric chair, his chair now as he's moving around, he can cope with these impairments. I think really if he were to suffer any significant cognitive diminution, he would not be an effective leader of the church. But we're not there yet.
The name of the book, The Jesuit Disruptor, A Personal Portrait of Pope Francis. And we have been pleased to have Dr. Michael Higgins with us, a Sacred Heart University professor emeritus. And there will be this panel discussion tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, February 27th, at the Frank and Marissa Martiri Center for Liberal Arts and the Dr. Michelle Loris Forum about the book, about the pontiff, with a fascinating panel. Dr. Higgins, thank you. We appreciate the time and good luck tomorrow night, and we shall chat in the future, I'm sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Take care now.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. So there you go. Joining us right now, we've had her on the program before. You hear her on the top of the hour news here, and you see her on CBS News, Olivia Rinaldi here. And Olivia, great to have you with us. I guess there was a cabinet meeting today. Some guy named Musk showed up. What was that like?
Yeah, that cabinet meeting today went a little bit off the rails, certainly taken over by Elon Musk for a bit of time there, where he talked about the efforts of Doge and, you know, wearing the shirt that said tech support, if you were able to see
I did. I saw that.
Yeah. And he said it's almost a literal description of the work that the Doge team is doing. So notable interaction there from him in the Oval Office. But he talked about what they're doing, what Doge is intending to do. And he said that They're hoping to get to $1 trillion in cuts. He says that would be about 15% of the budget, and also claim that if spending continues at the current rate in the U.S., that the country will go bankrupt. But all very interesting that he did kind of co-opt the meeting for a little bit there. And seemingly at the behest of Trump, he was there on invitation, of course, to be at that cabinet meeting, but taking it over for a little bit to talk about their efforts and talking about his focus and the focus of DOGE.
Yeah, and finally, Olivia, did I read or hear some sources saying, you know, it seemed like there might be a little bit of uncomfort from either Trump himself or within the cabinet, like they're trying to put on a good face, but some of these cuts they're really worried about? Is that a buzz you're getting up there or not?
Well, we have heard some pushback from some of these cabinet secretaries against that email that Musk sent out, and it was sent out by the OPM earlier this week, saying that you have until the end of the day on essentially Monday to respond about the five things you did last week. Some agencies pushed back and said, look, a lot of the people that work here do classified work. They shouldn't be responding to a generalized email, and it raised national security concerns.
Yeah.
Trump, though, in that cabinet meeting today did joke. He said, quote, if you are to any of the people who disagree with Musk, he said, if you are disagreeing with him, we'll throw you out of here. And that was met with some applause and joking from around the table. And then he went on to say that his cabinet members have a lot of respect for what Elon is doing. And there may be some that disagree, but for the most part, everyone is happy with Musk there. So the question still remains, though, you know, a lot of the work that DOGE is doing, are they the ones who are making these cuts, or are they making the recommendations for the cuts that are then up to the secretaries? That's what the White House is saying. But it certainly seems like Elon is making a lot of these movements and emails and directing people to do these things at the behest of Trump, not necessarily of the cabinet secretaries.
Yeah, so basically some security analyst is not going to say, hey, one of the things I did last week was eavesdrop on Vladimir Putin. That probably is not going to be in there. Is that what you're saying?
It seems like a national security risk, doesn't it? I would wonder.
I think so. Olivia Rinaldi, CBS News. Olivia, as always, thanks. We appreciate the time. Take care.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Yeah. Name the five things you did last.